Chapter 15, Healthcare, by Janine Interlandi. It was the signature policy proposal of the nation's first black president, a sweeping overhaul of the healthcare system that broke a decades-long stalemate and brought health coverage to nearly 20 million previously uninsured adults. It has now been nearly a century since Theodore Roosevelt first called for healthcare reform. President Barack Obama told Congress in the fall of 2009, "Our collective failure to meet this challenge year after year, decade after decade, has led us to a breaking point." When the Affordable Care Act, ACA, Obamacare, as it quickly became known, was signed into law, Vice President Joe Biden was heard leaning over to Obama and whispering, "This is a big fucking deal." Bigger, perhaps, than Biden even knew. In the decade that followed, Obamacare became a touchstone for both sides of a political debate that swung numerous state and national elections, Republican promises to repeal and replace the law, and Democratic vows to save and strengthen it have echoed down through just about every national election since the original bill was signed into law. On the surface, these were fights over how to fix the nation's exorbitantly priced and deeply inequitable healthcare system. But as charges of socialism and fear-mongering over death panels soon revealed, deeper anxieties were also at work. The United States is the only high-income nation that does not guarantee some form of healthcare to all of its citizens. Medicine here is a commodity, and access to it depends on a suite of factors, including age, income level, employment status, geographic region, and, to an alarming and undeniable extent, race. African and Latino Americans have the highest uninsured rates in the country and, as a result, shoulder a disproportionate burden of the healthcare system's failings. They are more likely to die during pregnancy or from cancers that are treatable when caught early, and more likely to suffer the worst outcomes associated with chronic medical conditions like diabetes. But while the picture is particularly bad for people of color, they are hardly the only ones suffering from the healthcare system's failings. In fact, America has the lowest life expectancy, the highest incidence of chronic disease, and the highest rate of avoidable hospitalizations and avoidable deaths when compared to other high-income countries, despite spending more money on healthcare by far. The ACA managed to put a measurable dent in at least some of these grim statistics, but its successes have been uneven and precarious. Republican-led states have spent years resisting the law however they could, including through relentless legal challenges and misinformation campaigns. 12 states, most of them in the former Confederacy, refused to participate in the ACA's central provision, an expansion of Medicaid, the federal program that provides health coverage to low-income Americans. And in at least 12 other states, Republican lawmakers have tried to restrict access to that program through cumbersome work requirements. This struggle between using state resources to provide citizens with health care and withholding those resources from people deemed unworthy of support has become one of the biggest conflicts in contemporary politics, not to mention an incredibly consequential debate for the future of the country's health and well-being. But it's not new. It began during Reconstruction with 4 million newly emancipated African Americans. In the aftermath of the Civil War, the nation faced a full-blown humanitarian disaster. Freed people did not have enough food, clothing, shelter, or medical care. They were plagued by dysentery, cholera, and a bleak roster of other diseases. And they had no reliable help for addressing these problems. Hospitals were few and far between at that time, and most of them were either overwhelmed by the needs of white citizens to whom hospital administrators granted priority, or unwilling to admit formerly enslaved people under any circumstances, or both. As a result, The death toll of black people surpassed that of white people by an overwhelming and consistent margin. As the historian Jim Downs details in his 2012 book, Sick from Freedom, the newly emancipated died in such high numbers that in some communities their bodies littered the streets. Smallpox was one of several killers that hopscotched across the South during this period. It invaded the makeshift contraband camps where black Americans had taken refuge during the war, but left the surrounding mostly white communities comparatively unscathed. The pattern of affliction was no mystery. In the late 1860s, scientists had yet to discover viruses, but they knew that poor nutrition made people more susceptible to illness and that poor sanitation contributed to the spread of disease. They also knew that quarantine and vaccination could help quell outbreaks. They had used those tools to prevent the very same diseases from ravaging the Union Army. In one of their first attempts to claim the rights of citizenship, at least some freed people asked that the same methods be employed in their own burgeoning communities. As Downs notes, one group of newly emancipated men asked for humane quarantine facilities to be erected. Others asked for latrines to be moved away from tents in refugee camps. But rather than help these communities, Downs writes, medical authorities often blamed them for causing diseases to spread. Some of these debates took place in the context of the Freedmen's Bureau. Congress had established the Bureau in 1865 as a federal entity meant to oversee the transition from slavery to freedom, including helping the newly emancipated become a paid workforce at the close of the war and ensuring that they were treated equally in judicial procedures. But elected officials were deeply divided over what this Bureau's responsibilities should be, or whether it should even exist at all, and some of the disputes concerned health care. Some lawmakers, including a contingent of radical Republicans, believed it was the government's duty to provide medical assistance and other aid to freed people. Opponents of the Bureau, including President Andrew Johnson and most Democratic members of Congress, argued that such assistance would only breed dependence, which would keep freed people from returning to the plantations where their labor was still needed. Black people were idle and depraved by nature, they said, and when it came to black infirmity, hard work was a better salve than any medicine. Nevertheless, in 1865, the Bureau's commissioner, General O.O. Howard, inaugurated its medical division, which in turn worked to establish a system of hospitals for the formerly enslaved across the post-war South. The program was unprecedented, the first federally funded healthcare system ever created in the United States, but its goals were never entirely humanitarian. The Bureau director put in charge of the program aimed to provide just enough care to just enough freed people to maintain the plantation labor force. And from the start, the program's efforts were mired in anxiety over black dependency. Officials deployed a mere 120 or so doctors across the war-torn South, then ignored those doctors' pleas for personnel and equipment. They erected more than 40 hospitals, often in response to specific medical emergencies in specific jurisdictions, but shuttered most of them long before those emergencies had been resolved or the freed people's medical needs addressed. These contradictions reached their apotheosis in the fall of 1866, when white doctors in Charlotte, North Carolina, discovered smallpox in their city's only hospital for freed people. Terrified, and with no other means of preventing the disease from spreading, they did the only thing they could think of. They burned their own hospital to the ground. As the smallpox epidemic persisted and the death toll continued to rise, those who opposed providing any assistance to freed people developed a new and darker argument. Black people were so ill-suited to freedom that the entire race was going extinct, and the best lawmakers could do was let nature take its course. No charitable black scheme can wash out the color of the Negro, change his inferior nature, or save him from his inevitable fate. Ohio Democratic Congressman Samuel Cox said in 1865, on the floor of the House of Representatives. Several newspapers agreed, including the New York Times, which wrote that the mortality of the Negroes continued to be very great, and that dirt, debauchery, idleness are the causes of this inordinate mortality. One of the most eloquent rejoinders to this theory of black extinction came from Rebecca Lee Crumpler, the nation's first black female doctor. Crumpler was born free and trained and practiced in Boston. But at the close of the war, she joined the Freedmen's Bureau and worked in the freed people's communities of Virginia. In 1883, she published one of the first treatises by a black writer on the burden of disease among black communities. Her book, which addressed black women specifically, was intended to serve as a call and a guide for the newly emancipated, a message that they could and would survive even amid so much hatred and neglect. But Crumpler might as well have been speaking to Congressman Cox directly when she wrote that the nation's lawmakers seem to forget that there is a cause for every ailment and that it may be in their power to remove it. Those causes were external, she explained, not innate. Crumpler died in 1895, but her spirit lived on in an organization founded that same year, the National Medical Association, NMA, a pioneering organization of black doctors. Its first president, Robert F. Boyd, had been born into slavery. Through annual conferences and its own medical journal, the NMA became the leading voice on issues surrounding the health and medical treatment of black people and other disadvantaged groups. As the founding editor of the organization's journal wrote, the NMA was conceived in no spirit of racial exclusiveness, fostering no ethnic antagonism, but born of the exigencies of the American environment. And one of the best ways to improve health outcomes, the NMA understood, was through increased access to health care. At the start of the 20th century, the group began to argue for nationalized medicine. This argument, of course, went nowhere. In the decades following Reconstruction, the former slave states came to wield enormous congressional power through a voting bloc that was uniformly segregationist and overwhelmingly Democratic. During the 1930s, Southern congressmen headed many of the key committees in Congress. They used this power to ensure that New Deal measures did not threaten the nation's racial stratification. For example, as the Columbia University historian Ira Katznelson and others have documented, it was largely at the behest of Southern Democrats that farm and domestic workers, who made up more than half the nation's workforce at the time and an even higher percentage of the black workforce, were excluded from New Deal policies, including the Social Security Act, the Wagner Act, which ensured the right of workers to collective bargaining, and the Fair Labor Standards Act, which set a minimum wage and established the 8-hour workday. The same voting bloc ensured that states controlled crucial programs like aid to dependent children and the 1944 Servicemen's Readjustment Act, better known as the GI Bill. In the South, especially, state leaders then excluded black Americans from these programs through a variety of dubious mechanisms, including by creating onerous and subjective tests for determining need. Southern Democrats also secured local control of other federal health care programs under the mantra of states' rights. In 1945, when President Truman called on Congress to expand the nation's hospital system as part of a larger health care plan, they obtained key concessions that excluded black Americans, both explicitly and implicitly, and would shape the American medical landscape for decades to come. The Hill-Burton Act provided federal grants for hospital construction to communities in need and gave funding priority to rural areas, many of which were in the South and predominantly Black. But the law also put state leaders in charge of disbursing those funds and did not make any rule against segregating the new facilities. As a result, white communities were prioritized, and Black Americans in the rural South were left in the worst of circumstances, living in the least resourced part of the country and deliberately excluded from the exact program meant to fix that problem. Employer-based health insurance, which took off in the wake of World War II, put yet another hurdle between African Americans and equitable health care. They were denied most of the jobs that offered coverage, says David Barton Smith, an emeritus historian of healthcare policy at Temple University. And even when some of them got health insurance, as the Pullman porters did, they couldn't make use of white facilities. White doctors helped widen the gap even further. Professional societies like the American Medical Association, AMA, allowed Black doctors to be excluded, medical schools barred Black students, and most hospitals and health clinics segregated Black patients. The cumulative effect of these and other privations was to leave Black Americans with statistically shorter, sicker lives than their white counterparts. But Black communities of the 1930s, 40s, and 50s were no more apt to accept these exclusions than their forebears. Echoing the efforts of Crumpler, Black women began a national community health care movement that included fundraising for Black health facilities, campaigns to educate Black communities about nutrition, sanitation, and disease prevention, and programs like National Negro Health Week that drew attention to racial health disparities. One of the leaders of this effort was the NMA. By the 1950s, after a decades-long debate, its members were pushing aggressively for a federal health insurance program that would serve all citizens equally, a fight that put them in direct, open conflict with their colleagues at the AMA. The AMA was vehemently opposed to nationalized health care. Its members had already defeated two such proposals in the late 1930s and 40s with a vitriolic campaign whose slogans still reverberate today. They called the ideas socialist and un-American and warned of government intervention in the doctor-patient relationship. In the early 1960s, when proponents of a national health plan introduced Medicare, the AMA quickly and aggressively revived those same arguments, and doctors' wives organized coffee meetings, where they persuaded friends to write letters opposing the program. Their effort, dubbed Operation Coffee Cup, secured an endorsement from Ronald Reagan, who, in 1961, recorded an album with a gravelly-voiced speech warning that Medicare would lead to statism or socialism. But this time, the NMA delivered a countermessage of its own. Healthcare was a basic human right, inextricably bound to racial equality. "Man is such a slow learner," NMA President William Montague Cobb said of the fight. "But let us recognize our mistakes and remedy them without having to repeat the historical process again and again and again." Together, Medicare and Medicaid helped bring hospital segregation to a circuitous but definitive end. The 1964 Civil Rights Act outlawed segregation for any entity receiving federal funds, and Medicare and Medicaid soon placed every hospital in the country in that category. The programs also secured reliable health care for whole swaths of the population, namely low-income and elderly Americans, for the first time. As has happened so often in our history, Black struggles for equality resulted in greater rights for all Americans. In its fight to secure health care for Black Americans, the NMA helped to dramatically improve access for citizens across the racial and socioeconomic spectrum. Many forces have prevented the United States from achieving universal health care, including a failure to properly regulate the trillion-dollar health care industry and a near-total unwillingness to grapple with the ethics of for-profit medicine. But the role of racism and the legacy of slavery cannot be denied. The same arguments about dependency in socialized medicine, equity and human rights, that thwarted the Freedmen's Bureau Medical Division in Crumpler's time and blocked universal health care during Cobb's time, have echoed down to the present day. People of color continue to suffer most from the failure to resolve these arguments. Black and Latino Americans still have the highest uninsured rates in the country and still shoulder a disproportionate share of the nation's poor health outcomes. But they are not alone. After all the debates and elections and bills and lawsuits, millions of Americans of every race, ethnicity, and political persuasion still don't have health insurance of any kind, and millions more are still forced to ration crucial medications or to forego critical procedures or to choose in some other way between receiving health care and meeting other essential needs. In the end, everyone is harmed.